1 John 2:3 through 2:6, the seventh talk in a series on John's letters, was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 23, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are in the middle of the first introductory section of the first letter to John, and we went over basically the structure of it last week. I'll review that here briefly, and then we're going to be looking at paragraphs 6 through 9 probably this morning. Last week we talked about in a little bit more detail what it looks like, the occasion into which John is writing this letter. In the first two paragraphs, he gives the standpoint from which he's writing and the purpose for writing the letter. The standpoint being, he is an eyewitness apostle, an authoritative spokesman for Jesus, who knows firsthand exactly what it is that Jesus taught. And he is being called upon, either at his own initiative or their initiative, he's being called upon to clarify something. Namely, there are people who have come along in these churches and villages and communities that are arguing that the apostolic Christianity is wrong, that it's a distortion. It's not what Jesus taught. And in my best judgment at this point, instead, what they're putting in its place is some kind of reversion back to Pharisaical Judaism. And so what they are arguing instead is that Jesus was a good rabbi who taught us to obey the law, to keep the law, and gain eternal life through our obedience to the law. This letter is written to people who have never met apostles, apparently, who've never had any direct contact with people who knew. So it's the word of their fathers and mothers against the word of these false teachers. And one way to clear that up is to have an apostle, at this point probably the only apostle still living, address the situation. John, what was the truth? What did Jesus teach? What were the facts of the matter? So John writes, he says, about things that he had seen with his own eyes and heard with his own ears and touched with his own hands. And his purpose is so that the joy that they have experienced in having embraced the gospel and believed the gospel could be, as he puts it, made full. And I think what he means by that is that joy can be enjoyed because you can have the confidence that you have not been misled, but that you are in fact on track with the truth itself. Then in 3 through 9, John lays out three criteria, and we've already looked at the first criteria in 3 through 5. In 3 through 5, basically, John says that the only one who has embraced the light that was revealed by Jesus, and by the light he means that understanding of reality that actually, in fact, illuminates who we are, who God is, what God's purposes are, what's going on in reality. That understanding of things that illuminates our situation that was brought into the world by Jesus and taught to us by Jesus. It's only the one who embraces that light revealed by Jesus who shares a view of reality with God himself and therefore stands to inherit eternal life. And that's a criteria that John is going to apply in two directions. On the one hand, he's going to apply that criteria in order to discredit the false teachers because they are not embracing the light revealed by Jesus. They are rejecting it and running from it. And on the other hand, he's going to use that to encourage his readers by arguing that because you have embraced the light, you indeed do know the truth from God, the Father, and you are going to inherit eternal life. So that's where we've got so far. And now we come to paragraph 6. And in paragraph 6, we have the second criteria, basically. And what I'm going to argue here is that this criteria is that only the one who embraces what Jesus taught and lives his life in the light of that teaching is an authentic follower of Jesus who can legitimately claim to know him. And again, he will apply that in two directions. The false teachers are claiming to know Jesus, whether they're claiming to have had firsthand personal contact with him or whether they are merely claiming to know people who did and therefore to have a direct conduit to the teaching of Jesus. Either way, they're claiming to authentically know Jesus. And John is going to argue that's a lie. They don't know Jesus. It's not the case. And the reason we know that is because they don't embrace what Jesus taught. John is in a position to know that because he knows what Jesus taught. And then he's going to apply it again to his readers to encourage them to the extent that they have believed the truth that Jesus taught. They in fact do know him and are authentic disciples, authentic followers of him. Okay, that's what we're going to find here. Let's look at the pieces. Now by this we can know whether we have known Jesus if we preserve his instruction. The one who says that he has known him and yet is not preserving his instruction, he is a liar and the truth is not with him. But whoever preserves his account, surely in that one God's love has brought about its natural result. By this we can know whether we are with him, with Jesus. The one claiming to remain with him is under obligation to walk, just like that one himself in fact walked. Beloved, I am not writing to you with a new teaching, rather with an old teaching that you have had from the beginning. The old teaching is the discourse you have already heard, and yet again I do write to you with a new teaching. This is true with respect to him and with respect to you, because the darkness is fading away and the true light is already shining. The one who says he is in this light but who hates his brother is still in the darkness even until now. The one who loves his brother, he continues in the light, and there is no cause of stumbling in him. But the one who hates his brother, he is in the darkness, and he walks in this darkness, and he does not know where he is going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. Okay, I've changed my mind a lot about the details of the translation of 6 and 7. Let me read my newer version here just to give you a feel for where I'm going here. No significant changes, but worth taking another look at. Now by this we can ascertain that we know Jesus if we keep Jesus' instructions. The one who says that he knows him and yet is not keeping his instructions, he is a liar and the truth is not within him. But whoever accepts his account, surely in this one God's love has attained its intended result. By this we can ascertain that we are followers of Jesus. The one claiming that he remains a follower of him, he is himself under obligation to walk just as that one walked. And we'll talk about the details of that now. First of all, why the we? We can know, or we can, as I put it in my second translation, we can ascertain that we know him. Who's the we? This is one of the things that makes John, the letter of 1 John, so difficult, such a mind-boggling book to exegete, is because he has all these pronouns, and there are four different possibilities, all of which seem true, as to who this we might be. And you have to sort out what exactly does he mean here. Because he uses it so often in so many different sorts of context, what makes the most sense to me is that John is using an idiom that we use as well. We wouldn't use it in the places that he uses it. But where we talk about we, when what we mean is some indefinite person, whoever that might be, any one of us is the idea. We would probably, in our written English, in our kind of stuffy, pretentious written English, would probably say, use the word one. If one, by this one can know that one knows him. By this one can know that he knows him. Something like that. So I think that's the sense in which he means it. We might use that idiom. I'll give you two sides of the political spectrum here so that you can't nail me down. But we have to defend our country if we want to preserve our lifestyle. Well, who's the we? I mean, do I mean me and some soldier in my pocket? No, probably not. I probably simply mean, as a general principle, anyone needs to defend their country if they want to preserve their lifestyle. One does, doesn't one? Or, on the other side, we have to pursue peace if we want to avoid war. Such profound things come out of political discourse. Again, it's the we is simply an indefinite. One needs to do this, doesn't one? I think that's the sense in which John means it here. The more difficult problem is, who is the him? I in my translation, I supply Jesus, and that's my answer to it. But the text just has the pronoun. in order to know whether we know him, we know by this that we know him. Who's the him? Okay, bear with me here. This is a complicated argument. Again, this is why this is so difficult, why 1 John is so difficult, because could it be God? Absolutely. Because we're going to see in some passages I'll read from the Gospel of John that Jesus makes a huge point out of, if you know me, you know him. If you know him, you know me. There really is, in the end, no distinction between knowing Jesus and knowing his Father. It comes to the same thing. But since it comes to the same thing, it makes it an exegetical nightmare to figure out which of them is being talked about in a passage like this. But I'm arguing that here it's Jesus. And here's my reasoning. First of all, in paragraph 3 earlier, he talked about, and this is the message we heard from him. And again, it's him. The him there, though, I think is clearly and unmistakably Jesus, right? Because he goes right on to say, this is the message we heard from him, God is light. And I, especially following on the heels of paragraph 1 and 2, it seems quite clear to me that what he's saying is, Jesus was sent into the world by the Father to reveal the truth to us. What was the truth that he, Jesus, revealed to us? What was his, Jesus, message to us? I think there's no mistaking the fact that that's what he means there. And then in paragraph 4, he talks about, how does it go? Help, my paper clips are wrecking me. If we say that we have not sinned, we make Jesus a liar, and his account is not with us. And the word there is logos. His logos is not with us. Okay, that seems clearly to be Jesus. We make Jesus a liar, and his, I think, Jesus, logos is not with us. He's saying the same thing there that he was saying in paragraph 3. This is Jesus' message, but if such and such is not the case, Jesus' message, his account, his logos that he came to deliver to us is not with us. So, paragraph 3 and paragraph 4, seems to be Jesus. Jesus' message, Jesus' account. So most probably then, when we get to paragraph 6, the logos in paragraph 6, how did I translate it? I translated it account, I think. Yeah, whoever preserves or keeps his account, again, that's logos. Whoever preserves or keeps his logos, that most likely is Jesus, just as it is in 4, just as it is in paragraph 1, and just as it is in paragraph 3. That seems to be the most probable way to take it. So what is it? It's this message that comes to us from Jesus that's ultimately sent from God, the Father. That's true. So it's ultimately the Father's message, but it's most immediately and most directly the message of Jesus, this teacher who came to teach us. So in the light of that, look at some passages out of the Gospel of John. John talks about keeping Jesus' logos in 8:51. If anyone keeps my word, he will never see death. And he equates that with hearing his word in 8:43-47. Why do you not understand what I am saying? This is Jesus speaking. Because you cannot hear my word. So because I speak the truth, you do not believe me. He who is of God hears the words of God. For this reason you do not hear them, because you are not from God. And then later in John 14, if anyone loves me, Jesus speaking again, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. He uses the same word that we're going to have here in 1 John, instructions, Jesus keeping Jesus' instructions. John 14:21, he who has my, they translate it commandments, he who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me. He who loves me will be loved by my Father. John 14:15, if you love me, you will keep my commandments, or I will argue instructions. We have persisting in or abiding in Jesus' logos, his word. John 8:31, if you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. But Jesus later, or no, actually in the same chapter, argues that his logos, his word, is one and the same as the Father's logos, the Father's word. And to know Jesus is to know the Father. So in 8:55 he says, "And you have not come to know him," Jesus speaking of the Father, or telling them they haven't come to know the Father, "you have not come to know him, but I know him. And if I say that I do not know him, I will be a liar like you. But I do know him and keep his word." Not very diplomatic of him, by the way. John 14:7, "If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on you know him and have seen him." So I think what John is doing here is echoing these sentiments that you see in the Gospel of John here. Jesus' word is the Father's word, that's true, but how do you know that you know the Father? How do you know that you love Jesus and therefore love the Father? How do you know that you hear Jesus and therefore hear the Father? If you keep his teaching, if you keep what it is that he taught you. That seems to be the sentiment, and I think that's what John is talking about in 1 John. So, the next question then is, what exactly do we mean by keep? I think there's a lot of confusion, I think, that has been engendered by our idiom of keeping his commandments. If you're like me, you've spent most of your life wondering whether you ought to read 1 John or not, because it's so discouraging and so condemning, guilt-producing. Because who of us can say, in the sense that we mean it in our idiom, that we keep his commandments? You know, Jesus said, for example, if we're talking about Jesus, Jesus said, "Love your neighbor as yourself," quoting the Old Testament law. Well, have I done that? Have I kept that commandment? If I'm honest with myself, if I'm ruthlessly honest with myself, I fall way short of loving my neighbor as I do myself. Am I not keeping his commandment? It would seem that that's the logical thing to conclude. No, I'm not keeping his commandment. But I would argue that's not what John means. As often has happened in English, the Bible was such a powerful book in our culture and in English-speaking culture that it actually shaped our language. Much of our idioms today are words lifted out of the page of the Bible and turned into a way of speaking. It actually formed and shaped our idiom. And I would say keep in this usage is probably one of these things. So we today will talk about keeping the law. Well, what do we mean by keeping the law? I think what we mean by keeping the law is just flat out obeying it, doing what the law says to do in such a way that I'm not a criminal. So keeping has become a synonym for obey. Where did that come from? It came from generations of people reading their King James Bibles and reading these passages about keeping Jesus' commandments and so on and so forth, and realizing and thinking to themselves, keeping his commandments obviously should mean obeying his commandments, right? That would make sense. And so, over time, because that becomes a stock interpretation of that phrase, it actually shapes our and forms our idiom. So, in our language today, to keep the law is to obey the law. It just is. But I don't think that's what John meant. And that's what we need to understand in order to understand exactly where he's coming from. The word had a long-standing history, or the idea, I should say, the concepts has a long-standing history throughout the Old Testament. Where you meet it abundantly is in the book of Deuteronomy. Moses stands before the nation of Israel and say, God is wanting you to keep the instructions, the ordinances, the statutes, the judgments, etc., 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 that I am giving you this day. You are to keep them. In our idiom, we think what he's saying is, you are to obey them. But that's not exactly right. It involves obedience, yes. Obedience is certainly part of it, or obedience is certainly an implication of that, or at least a certain kind of obedience is an implication of that. But it doesn't exhaust what it means. In my second go around, I decided to keep the word keep in this passage rather than preserve, as you have, I think, in your translation before you, precisely because I'm not sure it really is translatable into any other terms. It's better to keep the word and understand what the word means than only take a part of what it means and narrowly define it in those terms. Keeping is to, how did I put it? Keeping is to embrace it within my entire being, I think. It's to embrace, it's to acknowledge the worth of it, it's to acknowledge the value of it, and because I acknowledge the worth and the value of it, I protect it, I guard it, I preserve it, I don't allow it to be distorted, I don't allow it to be changed or altered. I live my life in the light of it because it's valuable and true. It's all of that, I think. And it's a very pregnant term that captures exactly what being a disciple is really all about. It's to look at the teaching of Jesus and to say of the teaching of Jesus, that's it. I want it. I don't want anyone to mess with it. I don't want to mess with it. I want to make that the center and the defining reality around which I define my existence. It's everything to me. That's exactly what God was asking Israel to do in Deuteronomy. I want you to keep these statutes and commandments these days. Did it mean he wanted them to obey them? Yes. Did it mean he wanted them to preserve them without distortion and without alteration? Yes. Did it mean he wanted them to be passed down from generation to generation to generation so they didn't get lost lost to mankind? Yes. He meant all that stuff. And we could unpack all the different implications of what it would mean if you were keeping his commandments. We do have that other meaning of it, and we're familiar with it. When we talk about keeping the faith, for example, a term that comes out of 2 Timothy, when we talk about keeping the faith, we don't mean obey the faith. It includes that. What part of the faith can reasonably be obeyed? It means to obey it. So it includes that, but it means more than that. It means recognize the value of this truth and do everything in the light of its value. Act appropriately in light of how valuable it is to you. Embrace it. Know it. Understand it. Wrap your life around it. Do that. Don't let anyone destroy it. Don't let anyone take it away. Don't let anyone rob you of it. I mean, the root meaning of the term, the predominant usage in the Old Testament, are those people who live in those guardhouses by the vineyards to keep the foxes and robbers away. The keepers of the vineyard are the watchmen who are guarding, who are protecting, or they keep prisoners. They watch prisoners to make sure they don't escape. That's what we are to do to the instruction of Jesus, the truth, is to guard it, keep it, watch over it, be diligent. To make sure it is what it is and is appreciated for what it is by me and ultimately by others as well. That's what John's talking about, I think. By this we can ascertain, know, that we know Jesus if we keep his, Jesus' instructions. Now, most of your translations probably translate that commandments. Again, not wrong exactly, but the term, I think, has a broader meaning than that. And I think John is using it in a broader sense than that. It's not those dozens of commandments, imperatives that Jesus taught us that we are to keep. We are to keep the entirety of what Jesus came and revealed to us. Those facts about reality that we wouldn't otherwise know, those perspectives about reality that we wouldn't otherwise have, we are to keep those, embrace those, acknowledge those, don't oppose them, don't reject them, don't forsake them, keep them to ourselves, embrace them. So it's the entirety of the gospel message, the entirety of what he called earlier the light that we are to keep, not merely the imperatives or the commandments themselves. okay, you see, when you see what John is saying here, you see what a different perspective this brings than the one we're familiar with. If we just take it as keep his commandments and understand that according to our idiom to mean obey his commandments, this sounds awfully harsh as a criteria for discipleship. You mean I'm not an authentic disciple of Jesus if I ever don't love my neighbor? If I ever have a perverse, lustful thought? If I'm ever selfish? If I'm ever pride? If in all those ways that I break his commandments, am I demonstrating myself to not be authentic? That's not what John is saying. And remember the context here. The context here is that there's this whole wave of teachers coming into Asia at this time who are saying, Jesus isn't who you guys heard that he was. He didn't say what you heard that he said. He was just wanting us to obey the Mosaic commandment, to follow Mosaic covenant, to follow the Mosaic covenant. That's all he was trying to do. By saying that, they're repudiating the teaching of Jesus, the actual message that Jesus brought into the world. They're rejecting that entirely. So John has two kinds of people in mind here. Those people who altogether reject everything that was at the heart of Jesus' message, and those people who accept what was at the heart of Jesus' message. These are the people, in John's mind, who are keeping the teaching of Jesus. The false teachers are those who are rejecting it and opposing it. So he's not speaking at the level of scrutinizing the moral quality of every attitude and every thought and everything that I do, of looking at that with a fine-tooth comb to see if we can find any evil in us, and if we can find evil with us, worry whether we're an authentic disciple. That's not at all the context here. That's not what he's doing. They're very, very diametrically opposed sets of people here. People who embrace the truth and people who are actively working against it. These people keep it, and these people oppose it. And he's making a very simple point. If you keep it, you're an authentic disciple of his. If you oppose it, you ain't. You ain't no disciple of Jesus. If the very thing that he came into the world to give us, you won't accept, and you've rejected it. So, that's what he says. The one who says that he has not known him, or that he knows him, that he has known him, or I changed that to knows him, is probably more idiomatic for us in English. The one who says that he knows him and yet is not keeping his instructions, he is a liar. And all he means by that is he's lying when he claims to know Jesus, because he doesn't. And the truth is not within him. There, I don't think he's repeating himself. There, I think he's making a separate point. He's lying about knowing Jesus on the one hand, and on the other hand, he does not possess in his own understanding of things the truth. It's the truth that he's rejected, and having rejected the truth, he does not have the truth within him. On the other hand, he says, but whoever keeps his account, Jesus' teaching, but whoever keeps Jesus' teaching, surely in this one, that was actually a typo, it should have been this, surely in this one, God's love has, and I'm going to change it here slightly, God's love has attained its intended result. Now, we could just pass over this quickly, but I don't want to, because I think this is an incredibly, incredibly profound way for John to phrase what he's saying, because it gives us incredible insight into his understanding of God's purposes and reality. What I understand him to be saying is, if we are people on this side of the ledger who have kept the teaching of Jesus, rather than those people who have rejected it, forsaken it, and opposed it, then we are the ones in whom God's love has attained the result that he intended. We are right where God wants us. God's activity in the gospel is a manifestation of his love for us. God could have, from the heights of heaven, decided to damn the whole lot of us, and he would have been perfectly justified. utterly righteous to do so, utterly within his rights as God and judge and king and so on and so forth. He didn't have to do anything merciful toward any of us. But the fact of the matter is, he has shown us incredible, incredible mercy, sending his son to die on the cross, to be the propitiatory offering, to appeal to God for mercy on our behalf, in order that in the end we might receive mercy rather than what we deserve. The mercy of being granted the blessing of eternal life rather than the just condemnation of our destruction. It's all an act of God's mercy. But in terms of discipleship, John says, so what was it that God in his love was working to do? Well, he's working in your and my life to make us people who did acknowledge and see the value of the truth of the gospel. And we did embrace it, and we did wrap our life around it and define our being by its truth rather than forsake it and run from it. Why did we do that? Because God loved us. Most people are blind. Most people walk in darkness. Most people are ignorant and foolish. All of us, by nature, are people who walk in darkness, who are ignorant, who are foolish. We are clueless, apart from God in his love, working the magic and the miracle of giving us eyes to see and ears to hear, as Paul puts it, opening up the eyes of our hearts so that we can understand. If God had not done that, everything that we're talking about this morning would be just sheer, utter nonsense to us. Completely irrelevant gibberish. Stuff that's contemptible. Stuff that we laugh at. Stuff that we meet with nothing but derision. Because that's the way it looks to an unenlightened mind. But you and I have been brought here. You and I have been brought to a place where this, not only does it not seem like nonsense and gibberish, it does indeed seem like life itself to us. Why? Because God has loved us. God has worked in our hearts to make us individually a part of what's happening, a part of this truth, a part of this destiny, a part of this life that God came to bring. And that's the love of God miraculously working in our lives. But here's the most significant and profound part of what he's saying. He says, whoever keeps his account, surely in this one, God's love has attained its intended result. Now, in most settings, people would be really, really angry with what I'm about to say. This would be met with a tremendous hostility. But the fact of the matter is, What John is assuming when he formulates this, articulates the sentence, is that all God really wants to do and expects to do and intends to do in this life is to make us believers. Real believers, authentic believers, believers from the heart, not just surface believers who adopt to a cultural set of assumptions and do the culture and do the Christian thing and do the church. Sure, he wants deeper than that. He wants it to be something that comes from the depths of our being, where we genuinely, authentically believe that this is true. But in the end, that's what he's targeting in my life, here and now in this world, is to bring me to a point where I believe it, and that I believe that it's true from the depth of my being. There are all kinds of Christians out there in the Christian culture whose response to that would be, that's all? That's all he intends to do? That's all he wants? I mean, what about make me happy? What about bless me? What about make me prosperous? What about making me victorious over sin? What about making me a great missionary and a great evangelist and an effective servant of God who changes the world for Jesus and establishes the kingdom of God and all that stuff? What about all that? Well, that's not where John's coming from. Unless I'm completely misunderstanding what he's saying here, his perspective is God's love is being directed toward me, is being focused in my life on bringing me to a point where I really, truly, genuinely, authentically believe this stuff. Belief is not easy, it's hard. As a culture, we make it easy because we make it shallow. We make it superficial. All you need to do is say the right things. All you need to do is adopt the right smile and dress the right way and conform to the right lifestyle. And having done that, everyone around you will say, you are a child of God, a Christian in good standing, a disciple of Jesus. But from a biblical perspective, it ain't that easy. No, all kinds of people are going to be good Christians who never knew Jesus, who have never come to be an authentic disciple of Jesus. That's the hard part. It's a hard part that takes grief, it takes sorrow, it takes God waking us up with all the shocking realities, traumatic, painful, sorrowful realities of our lives, where he gets our attention and he focuses the issue on what is your existence really all about? Is my life so intertwined with the things of this world that when this world is destroyed, it's going to be destroyed with them? Or have I been able to untangle myself from the stuff of this world? Do I have it in perspective? Do I realize that it's not that important after all? Do I realize that life itself does not consist in the everyday little joys of convenience and pleasure and family and relationship and love and so on and so forth? All that stuff that is so compelling to us because it seems so real and so concrete and so tangible, that how can it not be the stuff that my life is made of? And yet, little by little, bit by bit, tribulation by tribulation, trial by trial, question by question, God faces me into the truth. I was made for something beyond this world. I was not made for this world, which is passing away. I was made for eternity, the eternal kingdom of God. And that is so hard to believe and so hard to understand and so hard to know that it is a lifetime project that God, a lifetime curriculum that God takes us through to convince us by degree, bit by bit by bit, by degree, that this is really the truth. And this needs to be the defining reality of my life. Okay? Wow. Let's go one more paragraph then, and I'm not going to make it to the end of 9. So then he says, by this we can know or ascertain that we are, now I had originally with Jesus, but what it, and it's literally in the Greek, that we are in Jesus. But in one of those other places where if you let yourself go, this can just wreak havoc in our theology. We have a tendency to read, you can know that you are in Jesus, first of all, literally, literalistically, and then secondly, because we take it literalistically and know that we're not physically in Jesus, obviously, we wax metaphysical. That what John is talking about is somehow I am in Jesus in a way that the non-believer is not in Jesus. And what does it mean to be in Jesus? Oh, well, don't you know? I mean, being in Jesus. And we have visions of being plugged into his power and protected by his might. And I mean, I don't know. We all probably have an individual picture of what exactly that means and what the ramifications are and what the implications are. But we've been misled, I think, by a false assumption. John is speaking in an almost slang-like language here, I think. So when he says, in Jesus, he's just using a preposition in this slang-like kind of way to be a very, very short and convenient phrase to describe a much more complex reality. And the much more complex reality is that we are in fact his disciples who belong to him as a disciple does to a teacher, in the sense that a disciple does to a teacher. That we have given our allegiance to Jesus as our teacher. That's what it means to be in him as opposed to in somebody else. John uses that phrase frequently, and I'm convinced that that's what he means every time, virtually every time he uses it. So he's simply saying the same thing that he said in the last paragraph. By this we can ascertain that we are followers of Jesus, disciples of Jesus, authentic disciples, the one claiming that he remains in him, a follower of him, The one who claims that he remains a follower of him is under obligation to walk just as that one walked, that one being Jesus. And about three or four times throughout this letter, John calls Jesus that one. I don't know why. That one. We are to walk as that one walked. And what is he talking about? How did Jesus walk? Jesus walked in accordance with how he taught. That is to say, Jesus believed his own teaching. What he taught us about the Father, he believed about the Father. What he taught us about the passing nature of this world, he believed about the passing nature of this world. What he believed about his purpose in this world and in this life and his calling in this life, he believed it. He believed it even to the point of going to his own death to fulfill it. He didn't balk. He didn't hesitate. He didn't run away from it. He didn't avoid it. He was given the opportunity in the temptation in the wilderness, and he said, no, I can't do that. I have a mission to fulfill. I got to do it. Why? Because he believed that the author of all reality had given him something to do, and he needed to do what he was given to do. He believed what he knew was true. And in not only believing it intellectually and giving intellectual assent to it, his whole life conformed to the truth of what he taught. That's the way we can know that we are authentic disciples. If we believe what Jesus taught and we have our life conformed to the reality and the truth of that teaching. In everything that we do, in everything that we say, in everything that we are, we believe the truth of the gospel and have it shed light on, therefore, who we should be and how we should act, what we should value, what we should do. Now, one of those things, we saw this earlier, but I'm just going to repeat it. One of those things that he taught us is that we are sinners. In paragraph, what was it? Paragraph 4, if we say that we have no sin, we are deceiving ourselves and the truth is not in us. So John is not saying to walk like Jesus walked is to live a sinless life, to pretend sinlessness, to make a pretense of sinlessness is false, not true, is to not walk in the light, not to walk in the light. And indeed, to make it my goal to be sinless is naive, not wise. It's gullible, not enlightened. Because one of the things that Jesus taught us is that we are incurably and intrinsically wicked people who will gravitate toward disobedience. We will gravitate toward perversion. One way or the other, we're attracted to that which is not good. So, of course, there are going to be manifestations of my sin, of sin in my life all the time. But if we walk as Jesus walked, we will call sin what it is. We will call sin, sin. We will recognize that sin is the serious matter that it is, that the sin in my life made me worthy of eternal destruction, eternal condemnation. I will know that, I will understand that, I will get that, and I will, in the light of that, respond accordingly. I will respond with gratitude to what Jesus did on the cross, knowing that there and there alone lies any hope for me in eternity. Because I have no basis to be able to expect anything other than condemnation from God unless God grants me mercy. So to walk as Jesus walked is to really genuinely, authentically believe what it is that he taught, and that the logical result of that in my life will be a certain way of looking at life, a certain set of attitudes, and a certain set of behaviors. And we can unpack those more if you want. But he's not saying live sinlessly as Jesus.
I'm wondering what time, what year this letter was written, and did they have written accounts of the Gospels yet at this time?
That's a good question. I don't know the year. I think it's late in the first century, so we're getting probably close to like 70 AD, probably. We're in the 60s or early 70s AD would be my best guess. And yes, There should have been gospel circulating at that time, I should think. So I suppose what's behind your question is, you know, why didn't he just send him a copy of the gospel or something like that? My guess would be that the same teachers who are calling into question, I mean, apostolic Christianity in these communities that he's writing to are pretty established, I think. Have a strong foothold. My guess is that the attack of the false teachers would be directed at the gospel accounts just as much as it is the teaching of the whoever the teachers are in their midst. Is that this is all fabricated, this is all made up, this isn't true. We know directly, we know for either firsthand or we know from people who know firsthand, and they told us that it was entirely different from this, and let us inform you what he really taught. So I don't know that a written gospel would have necessarily held any more weight than the teachers who were teaching the apostolic gospel to them.
Jeff,
as we see in our own day, it's easy to take a written account and just say it's all a pack of lies, it's not true, it's not authentic. Who's speaking?
Me. Next door.
Oh, okay.
When you spoke of the word keep, uh-huh. Now over the years that is informed and locked in our definition of it, our idiom.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other notions, other words, other concepts in Christianity that you suspect have also been infected that way?
Yes, there are. I'm not sure I can bring them to mind immediately, but I have run into others where, you know, you look at it and you go, "That's where our idiom comes from." I mean, this is what is behind it. But nothing comes to mind immediately. Maybe it'll surface here while I'm abide. I can't abide that. I would guess that is coming out of people who have been reading their King James Bible a lot.
Perhaps you've already touched on this. I wasn't here last week, so forgive me. Could you elaborate on apostolic Christianity a bit? You've alluded to it. You mentioned it. I'm thinking there's the notion of apostolic succession and so on.
Oh, no, that's not what I mean.
Right, I didn't think it was, but if you could kind of define it a bit.
Yeah, you mean just what I mean by that?
Yeah.
By that term? All I really mean by that term, we could say New Testament Christianity, and it would mean the same thing for me. I mean that understanding of the Christian faith that Jesus taught the apostles and that the apostles themselves passed on. And we have no access to it, except that fortunately in the New Testament the apostles wrote some stuff. And so we can sit at their feet through their writings and hear what it is that they have to say in the New Testament. That's what I mean. My view is that very, very quickly, I mean, you're even seeing it in the pages of the New Testament itself, very, very quickly within the churches, within the so-called Christian churches, distorted understanding of what Christian faith was really all about quickly crept in. And most of what we have inherited down through the ages, much of what we have inherited down through the ages as Christianity is actually a synthesis of what the apostles taught and Greek philosophy and mystery religions and a bunch of other influences that kind of got all wound up together and shaped what we have come to know as traditional Orthodox Christianity. And my whole contention is that authentic Christians are biblical Christians. They take their cues from the apostles themselves by studying and understanding and embracing the truth as taught by the apostles, not by tradition, not by orthodoxy.
I think you sort of started touching on this. I've kind of run into the idea in some of the more charismatic churches about apostolic authority, and kind of the idea is that, you know, the apostolic authority was passed on by the laying on of hands to another, and then by the laying on of hands to another. And the evidence that is kind of propels that idea is kind of the Elisha kind of thing, you know, where, you know, he wanted a portion of that. Or in Timothy, you know, where Paul says, you know, gee, I laid hands on you to kind of give you this gift. And so there's kind of this whole thing. a lot of my experience has been, you know, pastors say, well, I have apostolic leadership or authority, and it's kind of a, so whatever I say, I get straight from God. It's kind of, you know, that kind of a thing. So could you kind of, which of course is false, but could you kind of address, I mean, my take on kind of how you perceive it is that when the apostles died, apostolic leadership died with them.
Right. At least apostolic authority died
yes.
with them. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The primary basis for that would be, I can't remember which chapter in the Gospel of John, but that, you know, over the course of three or four chapters there, Jesus, in the Upper Room Discourse, Jesus is talking to the 12, and he's talking about how he's leaving and the Spirit of Truth is coming, the Parakletos, the one that I've translated, the Revealer or the Persuader, is coming. And the Spirit of Truth, at one point he says, speaking to the 12, the Spirit of Truth will lead you into remembrance of all that I said and did. See, he'll bring to your remembrance all that I have said and done and lead you into all truth. Okay. There's two aspects to what the Spirit of Truth is doing. No, there's two aspects to apostolic authority. Someone like John, why does John have apostolic authority? He's going to talk about both of these things in this letter before we're done. He's already talked about one of them. One reason that he has the authority to be able to be a spokesman for Jesus and tell us what Jesus taught is because he was there. He was directly, personally an eyewitness to the teaching of Jesus as he starts this thing. What I saw, what I heard, what I touched with my hands, what I felt concerning the word of life. So he had direct sense contact with the incarnate God coming into the world to reveal light to the world. He had direct eyewitness sense contact with him. That was one pillar of the basis of his authority. That, of course, would not be enough if he did not also have a supernaturally enlightened understanding. And that's the other role, that the Spirit of Truth will lead you into all truth. You and I can have the second part, or at least can have some semblance of the second part. We can be led to the truth. We can be led to an understanding of the truth. But I don't care how many hands you lay on me, I wasn't an eyewitness. And no hand laying can make me one. I wasn't there. And yet that's an indispensable component of what makes an apostle an apostle. So by its very nature, it's not something that can be handed down to past to future generations in any way, shape, or form, not the authority that they had, because part and parcel of that authority was their eyewitness status. Now, did that address your question?
Haven't talked to you on a microphone in a while.
No.
You would qualify Paul's experience as
yes.
an apostle a little differently. In a sort of way.
Well, Paul makes allusions that are not real clear, but he makes allusions to having been personally commissioned by Jesus and apparently personally instructed by Jesus. So, I mean, one of the things he says in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul was not at the in the upper room at the Last Supper, and yet he says, I passed on to you what I received, and talks about actually what transpired there. And some people have argued, and this makes some sense to me, that what he means by that, I mean, it could mean that he just heard it from some apostles, that's a possibility, but some people have argued that he was actually personally filled in and informed by Jesus himself about what transpired there. I can't even remember the reference now, but there's some reference about receiving from Jesus. Well, if that's the case, then he's really basically, he's different. He had a different experience than the other 12, but he's not lacking in the credentials that they had.
What were the apostles doing in Acts when they were picking someone to fill Judas's place? And that was before the Spirit came, I think.
Right.
Wasn't it?
I think that was symbolic. I don't think... Who won that? I mean, none of us know who won. Matthias? Who?
Sal.
Sal. He bribed his way into it. Whoever got ultimately chosen there, I think, was just to fill out the 12 as a symbolic group, the 12. Paul, I mean, some people argue, no, Paul was the 12th apostle. But I don't think that's the case. I don't think the apostles are actually limited to the 12. Paul, for example, is an apostle. Barnabas may very well be an apostle. That he's called an apostle at some point, but in what sense is another question. So Barnabas may actually be a bona fide apostle as well, but they're not part of the 12. But I don't think that's significant, because it's not, I don't think the point of the 12 is that they and they alone have apostolic authority. What gives you apostolic authority is a commission by Jesus. James is another apostle, I think. He wasn't part of the 12, but he was clearly an eyewitness and talked to Jesus and from all appearances was commissioned by Jesus. I have this for you to do. You are going to go out and be a spokesman for me. That's the other thing I think I'd add to the three, is that I think all the apostles receive some kind of direct commission from Jesus himself. This is who you are, and this is what you're going to do. So those are the things that make an apostle. Being a member of the 12 is just being a member of this symbolic, figurative group. It corresponds to the 12 tribes of Israel. And there's some kind of symbolic significance to that, I think.
I just want to go back for a minute to what you said earlier about believing being the big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess I just want to say thank you for that, because I think that is so huge. And it does seem like life is what does that. That not doing something profound or having an experience, or, I mean, so much of my early experience in the church was all about some experience that I have that says I'm now a Christian. But it seems to me that believing the gospel and hoping for the kingdom is really a hard thing to do in the midst of life's struggles. And it's just really refreshing to hear you say that that's the deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very striking to me for that reason. Thanks. Right behind you. Time for one more.
I guess I have one question. This was written to the church of Ephesus? Or
I think it's being written probably from Ephesus. I think that's probably where John is. But I think it's being written to a number of churches in the larger region of Asia.
I'm just curious, this kind of what I'm gathering from you, and I second what she says, you know, that we need to really believe from the heart. And people are coming and telling that, you know, it's not about believing from the heart, it's about just basically following the written word and keeping your commandments. Is this a problem that was predominant from your understanding in all the churches in that time? You know, this is fairly the beginning of Christianity, you could say.
Right.
Was that the major problem churches were facing? Was that just particular to that group or that audience?
Well, I think it's a major problem all over the Roman Empire. What has been striking after years and years of teaching 1 John from a very different perspective, what was striking this time around is to recognize John is confronting exactly the same sorts of issues, a slightly different flavor, but exactly the same sorts of issues that Paul confronted in Galatia when he wrote to the Romans. So Galatians and Romans in particular, Thessalonians. I mean, that every time, everything that they, whenever you have Jews becoming believers, one of the problems is they can't rethink their past habits within Judaism, their past way of looking at it within Judaism. And I think that's what's going on here, and I think every church had that problem. Something like Corinthians, they had a whole different set of problems because they weren't as Jewish, they weren't as Judaized. And so they had a lot more pagan influence there that were causing different kinds of problems. But whenever the predominant influence was Judaism, this is the issue.
Well, I would imagine it would be difficult as well for the Greek culture, because the Gentiles, I guess, a lot of them were Greek, right, back in that area, and they were supposedly seekers of enlightened knowledge, and that was, you know, kind of along the same, it was something, anything but coming from the heart.
Yeah, but I think the peculiarly Greek way of seeking enlightenment and knowledge and so on is going to be more of a problem later than it is right now. Right now it's primarily go back to the Mosaic Law, keep the Mosaic Law, gain God's favor through your keeping his commandments. Okay, I need to let you go.